welcome.
Audio brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Shabbat Parshat Shlach. Today, our first recording and first broadcast, Emir Tzashem, is the 15th of June, 06, the 19th of Sivan, which I should have said first, 19th of Sivan, 5766. We in Israel are reading Parshat Shlach. People in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, are reading Parshat Beha'alotcha. I explained at length last week when we get out of sync, why we're out of sync. It'll be a number of weeks until we're back. When we read Parshat Balak in Chutz La'aretz, they read Chukat and Balak, so they catch up. Or we lag behind by splitting them, or however you want to look at it. And in Parshat Pinchas, we will again be reading the same Parshat HaShavua. In the meantime, this show, Torah Tidbits Audio, as well as the written Torah Tidbits, printed I should say, and the electronic Torah Tidbits on email and on the website, are all reflecting Parshat Shlach. People in Chutz La'aretz can go to the archives from last week or previous years if they need Baha'alotcha. But this is for Parshat Shlach. Parshat Shlach has a special place in Torah Tidbits history. 14 years ago, the very, very first issue of Torah Tidbits was produced for Shabbat Parshat Shlach in 5752, June 1992. And it came about in the following manner. Shai Solomon, then director of the Israel Center, asked me to produce a one-page handout with activities of the center listed for distribution in shuls on Shabbat. His reason was that our only publicity up till that point had been the Jerusalem Post. He says not every English speaker reads the Jerusalem Post, and he wanted to hit English-speaking Jews who live in daven in shuls where they sort of cluster together, and this would be another way to publicize the activities. I expressed my reservations at the time that it was uncouth. I'm not sure that's the right word to give out a flyer of activities in shul on Shabbat. And after a moment's thought, I suggested that if he lets me put a Dvar Torah on one side of a page, I would put the schedule of activities on the other side, and we would go for the distribution. He said, fine, that's what I did. One side had a Dvar Torah for Parshat Shlach and a couple of other pieces of information about the Sedra, and the other side had the list of activities of the Israel Center. We printed up 60 copies on a photocopy machine and distributed them in two shuls with large English-speaking populations. And thus began the history of Torah Tidbits, where it has grown to be distributed in, well, I would say, countless shuls, because I don't have a good tally on them, but many, many shuls, many other places as well. Not 60 copies, but 8,400 copies is our latest regular weekly figure. At Chagim time, we up it to 85 or 8,600. And we always are coming up with new places to distribute Torah Tidbits. And that's part of the story. It's not two sides of a single sheet of paper. This week's issue is 48 pages. We've been up to as many as 60 altogether. Of course, there's advertising and schedules of activities and Tiulim information in addition to Divrei Torah, summary of the Parsha, halachic features, other articles, and I hope the listenership of Torah Tidbits Audio is familiar with the hard copy of Tidbits, or at least the email version and the website, www.ou.org/Torah/TT. And not that I'm recommending that you chas v'cholila slash the Torah, but that's how it's accessed. Interestingly, you could use a forward slash or a backslash, your choice. Torah with an H, T-O-R-A-H, another slash, and then T-T as in Torah Tidbits, and you get the page, and you click on any of the features, and you could see it in hard copy. Torah Tidbits Audio is not the same. It's called that because that's what I wanted to call it. And it does involve Divrei Torah, as you know if you're a regular listener, and music as well. This particular show is being recorded under unusual circumstances. I won't go into more detail, but it's being done in the field rather than at the office studio, neither of which is an accurate use of terminology. Before we continue, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena aznecha kashivot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmoria Adonai mi'ya'amod, ki imacha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivetan nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi'shomerim la'boker, shomerim la'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai kim Adonai ha-chesed v'harbeimo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashir yaha omidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. If you're listening to these words, it's a sign that the show ended up going out. Right now, it's a question mark on time and on method of recording and on method of transmission. It is all not the usual ways, but let's proceed. Let me go back to that first Devar Torah, because it became more than a Devar Torah. It became a sort of... let's call it, what do they call the ship, flagship of the kind of Torah that we share with the hard copy as well as on the radio, on the internet radio. And it sort of fulfills or typifies, let's say, the best possible way the extra message of Jewish and Torah life in Eretz Yisrael, specifically, more than just Judaism in general. It's one of the ways that we push for Aliyah, not so much in a recruitment way, but in the way of saying that this is the venue for the observance of Torah and Mitzvot. We have done very nicely in Chutz La'aretz, creating Jewish infrastructure and Jewish life to be as comfortable as possible on that Judaism level, in addition to whatever other comforts people have created in Chutz La'aretz. But it has to be recognized and realized that this is where God wanted us to be, and this is where God wants us to be, and this is the home of the Jewish people. And the more people realize that, the better off all of Klal Yisrael will be. In any event, I take you back 14 years and several years in between when we've elaborated and polished this Devar Torah. The original source for me was the book of Devar Torah on Parshat HaShavua called Ma'ayona Shel Torah, Wellsprings of Torah. And there was contained the following. The Arizal said that Bikurim is a tikkun for Chet HaMeraglim. the mitzvah of bringing the first fruits, bikurim, is a repair, an atonement more than an atonement. Let's call it a repair. That's a literal translation of tikkun, and I think it's an apt translation as well of tikkun, because things got broke, to put it in colloquial form, a long time ago, and every generation, including our own right at this minute, has the challenge to fix things. And that's what you do with a tikkun. The explanation, or first the first connection between the sin of the spies and bikurim, is the wording in this week's Sedra, where the Torah adds, after Moshe sends the 12 scouts on their journey, it says, V'hayamim yimei bikurei anavim. And those days, or that day, those days that they were sent, were the days of the ripening of the grapes. Grapes, of course, become significant in the story of the Meraglim, or the story of the spies, or scouts, however you want to call them, because of that picture that everybody is aware of two of the ancient Israelite spies carrying a rod between them, shoulder to shoulder, and dangling from that rod is this massive cluster of grapes. The Torah also tells us that the Meraglim brought back of the figs and of the pomegranates as well. But the image, which is perpetuated by the Ministry of Tourism symbol in Israel, by a wine company that uses the symbol, by a lot of tourist organizations that use some variation of the Meraglim bringing back the grapes, the connection there is even the Hebrew term, which sort of has a sound-alike in English, latur et haaretz, to tour the land. And you almost don't know which language you're referring to when you say the word. Anyway, I digress. Let's get back to first the beginning of the vort with the Arizal. The Arizal says Bikurim is the tikkun for Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, and you can work things out in the following manner. The spies took fruit from the land. The Bikurim bringer takes fruit from the land. The spies showed it to the people and used it, A, to verify that it is a very, very fine land. Take a look at these gorgeous fruits. But they followed it with an impassioned speech about how impossible it would be to live here, and discouraged and panicked a generation of people who were decreed to die out in the course of 40 years of wandering, rather than do what God wanted, which was to go into the land of Israel. The Bikurim bringer takes these fruits, and he goes into the innermost heart of the land of Israel, namely Yerushalayim, specifically the Temple Mount, specifically into the Beit HaMikdash, or into the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, to be more specific. And he presents this basket of Bikurim to God, so to speak, placing it at the side of the Mizbeach, the altar, and then giving it to the Kohen as one of his gifts, one of the dues of the Kohen. The Bikurim bringer speaks, not like the Meraglim did, more like Yehoshua did, and Kalev, or I should say Kalev and Yehoshua, for obvious reasons, because the Bikurim bringer tells the brief history of the Jewish people at the time, which we know well from the Haggadah, the Seder night, where it speaks of Yaakov and the family going down to Egypt and becoming a great multitude there and being oppressed and calling out to God, and God coming down to take the people out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, in order to bring them to the land of Israel, and the person says, and God took us to the land of Israel, and take a look at these fruits. I am thrilled and delighted to live my life here, to raise my family here, to farm the land here, or whatever. And the concept of joy is a very much a part of Bikurim. So that's what the Bikurim bringer does, and basically attempts to repair Chet HaMeraglim every single time he brings Bikurim, and every person who brings Bikurim affects part of that tikkun. The Mayon HaShel Torah continued and said that Rav Menachem Zemba, Hashem Yikom Damo, he was the rabbi or one of the rabbis in the Warsaw ghetto. He is known as the one who gave halachic religious sanction to the uprising, because it was not a clear-cut thing to be allowed to do, because many lives were put at risk and the result was not very good. But it became a symbol of a certain kind of Jewish resistance and strength. And he wrote a commentary to Mishnah, which points out the following in support of the concept that Bikurim, as the Arizal says, is a tikkun of Chet HaMeraglim. He said, take a look at Mishnah Gimel, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Aleph in Bikurim, chapter 3, Mishnah 1. It says there, how does a person go about taking the first fruits? He goes into his field. He sees a cluster of grapes beginning to ripen. Some figs, maybe, a pomegranate. In other words, the Mishnah is using random examples of fruits to bring as Bikurim. Now, first of all, it's not random. Second of all, there are only 7 species from which we bring Bikurim. And here you've got 3 mentioned in the Mishnah. As a for instance, why 3? Why these 3? And Rav Menachem Zemba says, same fruit that the Meraglim brought back. And that's important. Now let me move on to, not to change the topic, but to another aspect of this idea. I've said this in many different ways. I don't know if I said on the radio recently the analogy that I'm going to give, but I'm going to do it now anyway, because it really fits Parshat Shlach. In fact, now that I'm saying these words, I think a couple of weeks ago, I might have mentioned it, said I really should wait until Parshat Shlach. So I apologize for the repetition, but I think it's something worthwhile listening to and worthwhile sharing with your family, especially children, and especially people who know the TV program that I'm going to refer to. I have this hobby, I don't know if that's the right word, that when I see a TV show, a movie, read a book, or whatever, my mind stays open to trap an idea or piece of an idea to make it relevant to Jewish education. There was a series on television, which we had here in Israel also. I don't think we had the whole series, but we had a couple of seasons of it, called Early Edition. Early Edition was aired in the States in the late 90s. It takes place in Chicago. It's the story of a fellow named Gary Hobson, who I think owned a bar. But every morning in his apartment above the bar, when he would open up his front door, 6 o'clock or something like that, would be a copy of the newspaper on his doormat. Not a very uncommon experience that many people have who subscribe to newspapers. Only this wasn't subscribed to. This was watched over by a cat. And this was a unique newspaper, because it was not the day's paper, it was the next day's paper. He received a copy of the newspaper for the following day, tomorrow. He would open it, he would read it, and it would say something like, "Fire in a tenement claims 12 lives." And he would be challenged to see if he could prevent that from happening. This was news reporting that which had not yet happened. So he would go and look at the tenement that was supposed to burn the next day and try to figure out what he might possibly do to help the people avoid the tragedy. In most cases, he was successful. It was a very interesting show because each episode was different, not just more of the same. And he got into trouble a lot of times. He got into jail, whatever. Doesn't matter. What happened was every time he effected a change, the newspaper changed. He would open up the paper and read about the fire in the tenement that burned it to the ground, and miraculously everyone was saved. Then he knew he did something. Or even if he tried to prevent it from burning and it didn't work, at least he was able to save people, whatever. Not the point. The point is the idea of early edition. Not reading yesterday's news, not really even reading fast-breaking news, but to read tomorrow's news and be able to change it. Good fantasy, good fiction. As I said, enjoyable show. But I want to talk about the real early edition, the Torah. And let's use this week's Sedra Shlach as an example. You open up the Chumash and you read the portion at the beginning of Shlach about Moshe sending out the spies and what happened when they came back with their report and the panic of the people and the decree against the people and the killing of the spies and the decree to wander through the wilderness, etc., etc. Can we do anything about it? Is this an early edition of tomorrow, or is this a very, 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 very old newspaper report of something that happened more than 3,300 years ago? Well, on one level of looking at it, it happened, and it can't be changed because it happened. However, Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, and many, many other things in the Torah, by the way, the sin of the spies is not just one isolated piece of history. Unfortunately, it is a recurring theme in Jewish history. In fact, if you listen carefully and look carefully, you will see that the Meraglim, unfortunately, are alive and well.
Oh, ביום ההוא קראת השם את אברהם ברית למור לזרעך נתתי נתתי את הארץ הזאת ביום ההוא קראת השם את אברהם ברית למור לזרעך נתתי נתתי את הארץ הזאת הלך בארץ לאורך ולרוחבה כי בך לך אתננה ולזרעך עד עולם קום הלך בארץ לאורך ולרוחבה כי בך לך אתננה נתתי את הארץ הזאת לזרעך נתתי את הארץ הזאת לזרעך נתתי את הארץ הזאת ביום ההוא קראת השם את אברהם ברית למור לזרעך נתתי נתתי את הארץ הזאת ביום ההוא קראת השם את אברהם ברית למור לזרעך נתתי נתתי את הארץ הזאת הלך בארץ לאורכה ולרוחבה כי בך לך אתננה לאורכה ולרוחבה לזרעך אתננה לזרעך עד עולם לזרעך נתתי את הארץ הזאת לזרעך נתתי את הארץ הזאת לזרעך נתתי את הארץ הזאת
Anybody that visits Israel and comes back, goes back to his hometown and talks to his friends and family and people in his shul or club or whatever, and he says, well, I just got back, and why, they didn't take me to the usual places, but I saw the new stuff, and I saw the places tourists usually don't get to see, and I met with families, and I met with settlers who were expelled from Gush Katif, and how hard their life is now, and this is a problem, and that's a problem, all of which is a report of a meragel, a spy, a scout, to Jews eagerly awaiting to hear what he has to say about his tour of Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. And up till this point, in both the analogy as well as the original, not much you could do about it. The person's not supposed to lie. He's not supposed to say, oh, everything is fine in Israel. That's why here in Israel they say, Yihyeh b'seder, it will be okay. But they don't mean it's okay now, necessarily. When the person then adds the following editorial comment, or words to that effect, It is a lovely place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. He is committing the sin of the spies. Today, tomorrow, as well as yesterday. Anything like that. Any time a Jew speaks to his fellow Jews and says anything that discourages a person from committing himself to live in Israel. Forget it, you'll never do this, it'll take too long to do that. You know how long my friend waited for his washing machine? You know how long it took this guy in the bank? You know how long this happened, that happened? Whatever. Factual reporting is fine. Editorializing to say, therefore, we can't live there, or therefore it is too hard to live there, that is motzi diba al haaretz. That is slandering the land, and that is chet hamaraglim. It's a very, very serious offense. You don't want to live in Israel? Keep your mouth shut. I don't mean to sound, well, I do. Because that type of poisoning other people from considering Aliyah is a perpetuation of Chet HaMeraglim. Therefore, by our listening to Parshat Shlach, reading Parshat Shlach, studying Parshat Shlach, we have an opportunity to have not just an account of what occurred 3,300 years ago, but we have a way of reading about what's going to happen tomorrow and being challenged to do something about it. That means when you stand by and you hear somebody talk like this, you don't be quiet. You say, you should not say something like that. This is the place where a Jew should live. Yes, there are difficulties, but there is no difficulty that cannot be overcome, including a very, very disappointing, to say the least, government and its policies. But this Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, and the state of Israel is where every Jew belongs. Does not mean that everyone is going to be here later today or early tomorrow. It means this should be the target. A Jew should say, I live in Galut, I live in the diaspora, I live in exile, but my heart and my mind and my plans are to figure out how to get to Eretz Yisrael, to help my children get there, to help my parents get there, to help myself get there. Every Jew living in Israel, especially Olim of recent years or of old times, especially English speakers who have friends and family and contacts abroad, they are the ones that have the daily possibility of being a Kolev Ben Yefuneh, to say, if God wants us here, then we can do it, we will prevail, and to keep the Meraglim that stand up and attempt to discourage people from coming to live here, to have a way of arguing against them and putting them in their place. Not to just let them say whatever they want to say, whoever it is. We'll leave it at that. But that's part of Parshat Shlach. And I personally am very glad that Torah Tidbits had its birth on Parshat Shlach with that specific Devar Torah that I mentioned. And I've been taken to task for overdoing this Aliyah business. People say to me once in a while, what, the only thing you have to talk about is living in Israel, living in Israel, living in Israel. What is talking about Shabbos? What is talking about Kashrut? Well, the answer is I do, and I do. But it's important to talk about living in Israel, especially when I have the ear of the listener to Torah Tidbits audio, and many of whom live in Chutz La'aretz. And what I want to do is one of the columns that we have in Torah Tidbits called Chizuk and Idud. Anyone who lives here already still needs to be spoken to about how wonderful a Jewish life is possible here and how much it's going to improve in the future. And idud, encouragement of those people who need to make this commitment. Unfortunately, I'm behind schedule, and I'm going to try to get some more of the show recorded, but I'm encroaching on the broadcast deadline on the Arut Sheva. Perhaps I will make it longer for the OU radio broadcast, which is not pinned into a time slot. I said before, without going into details, I'm under very unusual circumstances this week, and I still feel it's important to say these things about Shlach. Speaking of which, I thought, maybe do something different for Shlach. And my answer eventually was, you really can't do anything different, because this is something that's very important to keep at and to say in different ways. And if one person gets hit in the right way by these thoughts, then hopefully it will have a benefit. My father, Zichrono Livracha, used to be very, very agitated. I've told this before in Arut Sheva as well. Used to be very agitated at Parshat Shlach, very uncomfortable reading about the Meraglim and knowing that people still do it. I mean, God was so upset that he wanted to destroy the people that he gave this harsh decree, which was a result of a mixture of chesed that allowed the bulk of the people to live and die out in the course of 40 years, thus delaying entry into the land. But it's a lot more than that. First of all, for women, I'd like to say that they were not implicated in Chet HaMeraglim. In fact, the episode in Parshat Pinchas of the daughters of Tzelofchad is very instructive, because we see from there the great love of Eretz Yisrael of these women, and the commentaries say, in contradistinction to the Meraglim, take a look at Benot Slavchad as representatives of womanhood. Gross overgeneralization, I would say, but still there's something to it. We have only men involved in this. And for whatever cultural reasons that might have been so, we can give credit for a different attitude on the part of the women. In any event, back to my father, he was he didn't understand how people could listen to this parsha and not squirm terribly uncomfortably. I try to imagine what a person who doesn't keep Shabbat but does go to shul feels when they read Zachorit Yom HaShabbat L'Kadcho, Sheshet Yamim Tavo, Thou Shalt Not Do Any Manner of Malacha on Shabbat. And this person does. Of course, it's not so easy to find a Shabbos violator who goes to shul on Shabbat, but there are. There used to be more, I think. There still are. Do they squirm? Does a person who eat non-kosher and hear in Parshat Shmini about what animals you're allowed to eat and what you're not allowed to eat, does he feel uncomfortable? I would hope so. I don't know. But does a Jew who considers himself to be Shomer Torah and Mitzvot, I think we're getting to an important point here, a Jew who considers himself to be completely Torah observant but does not have Israel on his agenda, I'm not saying does not live here. I recognize that there are different valid and less valid reasons for a person not living here. Parnassa, livelihood, is a major, major factor. If a person can't make ends meet, or even make the ends, let alone let them meet here, then he says, what can I do? I would love to live there, but I can't. All right, so you plan for retirement, you plan for your children, whatever. But the key there is, he said, I'd love to live there. I'm concerned for the Jews who consider themselves completely Shomer Torah and Mitzvot, Torah observant, and say, Israel, well, you got to be crazy to go there. and do not have it on their agenda, do not pine away for it, do not take every opportunity to visit perhaps, do not have their goals focused on including Aliyah, and suffice themselves with periodic visits, and it's not part of their agenda. If it's not part of the agenda of a Jew, I don't know if he could call himself completely Torah observant. Because, open up a Chumash, I can't say that you'll find this on every page, but very, very often, God tells Moshe, or Moshe tells the people, that God took us out of Egypt in order to bring us to the land of Israel, to live, to flourish there, to be safe there, to be secure there. And this is the place, and we have to make it into a better place than it is. Of course, there's no Beit HaMikdash, but I believe that we are partially responsible, probably wholly responsible, but in a certain sense of not putting coming to live in Eretz Yisrael on the agenda of every Jewish school and of every thinking Jew. Is saying a message to God that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, so, you know, let me know when you decide to put one there. It's got to be more. We have to be proactive, to borrow a term. I think I'm going to stop here. I'm going to ask the technician at Arut Sheva to put music for the rest of the hour. And my apologies. And hopefully I'll have more to say on www.ouradio, OU Radio, or radiou.org, and Lehishtamea. Shabbat Shalom, of course. Saying these words now to listeners on www.ouradio.org or www.radiou.org. This is after I sent an abridged version of this week's show to Arut Sheva for Israel National Radio. I have time and space constraints that I don't have on OU Radio, so I'm able to add things. But as I try to make clear without being detailed, this week's show was recorded under very unusual circumstances and did not allow for the leisure of a full-size show. So for OU Radio listeners, I added two or three musical pieces. The reason I say two or three is because I don't know if I'm going to add two or three. I'm about to do that before I send it off to New York. And hope it came out with something, and I hope the main point of Shlach got across. Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtamea.